The following tone is a reference tone, recorded at our operating level.
Everybody, and welcome to Squat Cobbler number 18. Fuck. I just had to get that out of the way to make sure we earn our explicit tag right off the bat, just in case it doesn't come up again. I'm sure it will.
I am totally going to take care of the explicit tag before we're done.
Are you? Now, my yes, curiosity is peaked, sir. Peaked.
That was unnecessary because I have us covered. So
wow. Okay. So we're going to do something different tonight. Well, we are going to do our introductions, but we're going to do something different tonight because, you know, we kind of gave you guys two great movie options with Street Level and this movie called Faces of Snuff. But tonight we wanted to give you some music options, which we'll explore in a little bit. But let's get the introductions out of the way. I'm Mike. You can find me at Official Pagan on just about everything.
And hi, everybody. I'm Kelly Tool at KellyThul on Twitter and Instagram.
But what about that other one?
So that's what I am there, too. But there's really no point in sharing it because
it sucks. And you guys saw the debate. You know that we won.
Easily.
Easily won. There was no real competition there.
We tried to prop Bennett up. You know, we brought in a ringer, Rebecca Kennedy, smart young lady. Even she couldn't salvage Bennett's pathetically constructed, ill-conceived arguments.
No, and Rebecca's great and an incredibly talented actress, but you know what? Snapchat fucking sucks, and we call it like we see it, and we're always right. All right, so speaking of the amazing things that we tell you guys about and how we're always right, there's been a lot of really cool music released this year, because other than that, it's been a really shitty year, I think, for a lot of people. But we've had good music to get us through it. And I thought it'd be cool, and I kind of talked this over with Kelly, since we've been talking about the Alice Cooper records and delving into music a lot, and both of us, you know, recommend music pretty regularly, I thought it'd be cool to kind of pick out some records that we thought were the best of the year. It's the end of the year. It's a good way to kind of wrap it up. And of course, everybody's going to get holiday gift cards. So maybe you'll get an idea of something to use those gift cards towards. So we're each going to give you five albums that we thought were five of the best of the year. Before we get into it, though, I do want to say that I came up, I don't know how Kelly came up with his list, and I'm curious to hear, but I decided because there's so many albums that came out that I loved, I did need to come up with some sort of a system to eliminate some. So I decided that I wasn't going to choose anything that I had any sort of involvement in, at the risk of sounding like there was, you know, some sort of bias there. So Pat Briggs' album Pervert is not on this list. It is an incredible album. You should definitely buy it, but I did contribute to it, so I didn't put that on there. Also, I decided to stick to new studio albums. So like other albums I've recommended, like Gensho from Boris and Merzbow, are not on here because half of that is reworkings of old songs. And there's also a great live record from Mayhem and stuff like that that didn't make my list only because I needed a way to shear it down. I stuck strictly to new studio albums that I had nothing to do with. Kelly, did you have any sort of formula when you were coming up with your five?
I did not put the caveat that it had to be new in terms of, so actually there's two of my five recommendations are either a live album, and actually one of them's a cover album.
Interesting.
So I did, however, choose not to do anything you were associated with.
Again, just to now, not show bias, right?
No, it's a different reason.
Well, see, and again, like the no live albums thing or you know, compilations or anything, it was more just to kind of pare it down. Otherwise, there would have been a list of like 20 albums and something that was just unwieldy and we couldn't really realistically work into one, you know, bite-sized podcast like this. How do you want to do this? You want to work backwards or work our way up? We'll start at number five and work our way up to our number one. I don't know your list and you don't know mine, so it'll be interesting to see if there's any crossover here.
If you were a betting man going, we have not shared our list. Do you think that there's going to be any overlap?
I actually don't, only because I put so much thought into this list and reshuffled it so many times and put these weird caveats on it that I think I came up with five that when I explain them will make sense to people, but on the surface are going to seem kind of weird. So just based on that, it's not that we, like if we had come up with a 10 or a 20 list, I think there would be a lot of overlap. But because of the way that I did this, I don't think so. What about you?
So what I heard there was you don't think there's going to be any overlap because you put thought into your list.
I mean, I don't want it to sound that way, but you are the guy who tied Billion Dollar Babies with the best Alice Cooper record. So, I mean, when you're on Pat Boone's side of musical taste, I'm going to say no, our top five doesn't have a lot of overlap.
Pat Boone and any right-thinking human being. So, it would be I'm going to stand by Billion Dollar Babies is no different. There's nothing better than it. There could be something equally as good, but there's nothing better.
If you're so confident in your selections, why don't you get us started then? What's your number five?
Okay, so breaking the Bilinski rule, no old material. I'm going with a live album to begin with, and that number five for me is a Neil Young album called Earth. It was originally released as streaming only on Tidal, and then later in the year was released as a double CD, triple LP on vinyl. So it's Neil Young live. He is his backing band for this is The Promise of Real. Promise of Real features Willie Nelson's son is a member of Promise of Real. And so they were doing they became his kind of backing band. And he had the previous year released an album called The Age of Monsanto, which was kind of a railing against banks being too big to fail, kind of the typical Neil Young thing that you'll go after in terms of corporate greed, corruption, and all of that. And The Monsanto Years is one of the songs from Age of Monsanto that is on this album. But it's Neil Young live with a good backing band. Got My Country Home, Vampire Blues, The Monsanto Years on it. He called it an ear movie because in addition to the live recordings and kind of pulled from the tour, Neil's kind of a quirky guy. And he said, you know, we started playing these songs and the whole earth started to interact with us. And so he's kind of introduced, kind of weave throughout this live album are crickets and thunder and animal noises and all these types of things. It's just, it's quirky in terms of that as Neil Young will be.
So it's like Neil Young produced by Yoko Ono.
Probably Neil Young meets the Pink Floyd soundboard.
Okay.
Let's drop some of this in. Let's drop a little bit of that in. So you'll get...
Now, are those sounds, were those things that were played at the shows, or are those things he added in post-production to the existing live recordings?
I believe they were added post-production.
Okay.
That's my number five is Neil Young's Earth.
Interesting. Now, are you generally a fan of live albums?
Generally, no. But when there's a good one, sometimes they're great. So things like Waiting for Columbus by Little Feat, love that album. The Kinks' One for the Road is another really good one. And then there were, and we'll get to it in other shows in the future, there are a few live Alice Cooper albums, like Fistful of Alice, that are pretty darn good too.
Yeah, live albums often are used by bands as just a stopgap or a way to fulfill a contract. But when they're done right, I think live albums are great. And there's a lot of live albums that I love. And there was a live album that almost made my list, but I decided not to do it because I needed a way to just pare down my list. So I will give you my number five now. So my number five is kind of a weird choice. And it was one because I talked this list out with a lot of people. I posted a thing on Facebook. I got a lot of responses, a lot of messages from people. And I talked it out with people that I know. A lot of people made the suggestion that somewhere near the top of my list should be Frank Ocean. Are you familiar with him at all?
I am.
So for anyone who doesn't know, Frank Ocean had his fans waiting and was dropping cryptic clues about his follow-up record because it had been a couple of years since he had released a solo album. And when it finally came out, it was actually a visual album on Apple Music called Endless to fulfill his contract with his previous label, followed up the very next day by another album called Blonde, which instantly overshadowed Endless. And some people say featured the much stronger set of material and was independently released also initially as an exclusive through Apple. And he made a significantly larger amount of money based on it. And there was talks of lawsuits and things like that. But that is the choice for my number five. It is not that Endless is a bad collection of music, but because you can't separate it from the video, I think it's kind of lost in the shuffle, whereas this was released as just a traditional album. So it makes it a little bit easier to consume during your work day or travel or anything like that, since you can listen to it as a traditional album. I think it's a really strong album. I think the production's great. There is one terrible song on there, and unfortunately is the first song on the album, which is why, for me, it doesn't make it nearer the top of the list. The first song, which is also the first single, called Nikes, the studio version of that song, because it's my understanding that the single edit of the song, which was used for the music video, has a different mix. The mix that is on the album has heavy distorted vocals, very heavily distorted vocals throughout the entire song, and it is grating to listen to. It is a really weak start of the album for me, but from that point forward, the album is very good with very few minor speed bumps here and there. It is a minus one bad song and excellent album.
Excellent. And so did his brother Billy join him for any of this or no?
No.
All right, I'll bring in number four. So this will be, I take care of breaking the Blinsky rule quick here. I get my first two, and it's by Ace Frehley, formerly of Kiss. And it's called Origins 1, which is a spoiler to the fact that this will not be the last cover album Ace does, and we're going to likely get an Origins 2. But I've always kind of been okay with some of the Kiss catalog, Destroyer in particular, pretty enjoyable album. Actually, there again, speaking of live albums, Kiss Alive, not too shabby either from a live album standpoint. Always for me in listening to Kiss, there was only one true musician. There was only one true songwriter.
And that's Gene Simmons.
Not Gene Simmons. It was one, you had a couple marketers, some excellent marketers, Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley.
Well, then who is it?
That'd be Ace.
Trademark Gene Simmons.
Yeah, who owns Ace, you know, oddly enough, the way it works out is that he gets all the, you know, royalties for this album. But it's a series of covers. It includes a couple of the some tracks he wrote for Kiss but did not sing, Parasite and Cold Gin. Cold Gin's always been kind of one of my favorite Kiss songs, ruined by the fact that Paul Stanley sang it. Finally getting a version with Ace, Ace having a little better influence, although Paul Stanley, of course, contributed to this album, which, again, probably was required contractually. But Street Fightin' Man is on here. Magic Carpet Ride is on here. And so way back in the day when Kiss released, they released individual solo albums, Peter Criss, Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley, and Ace. Ace did New York Groove, and it kind of established the fact that this was a guy that could go out and find a couple songs that he could kind of make his own and make really enjoyable. And so you get some of that same kind of treatment with Magic Carpet Ride and Street Fightin' Man. 2000 Man, another Rolling Stone song on the famous Kiss disco album Dynasty, was the only track that prevented me from throwing that album in the trash to begin with. So it's nice to see him out still kicking some things out. I'm actually looking forward to Origins 2. So Ace Frehley's Origins 1 is my number 4.
Interesting. So personally, I'm not super familiar with Kiss's catalog. I don't like them. I don't like their music. It's weird to me that especially the original members who are still in the band, they have some great guys backing them up, but the original members who are still in the band don't seem to be any better at their chosen instruments 40 years into their career, which seemingly is impossible, but somehow they managed to pull that off. Just generally not a fan. So that, I was aware of this album, and a lot of people actually spoke highly of it to me, but I've stayed away from it just because of the Kiss connection. Am I making a mistake? Should I be checking this out?
I think you should, because, you know, he was banished from Kissdom. So, you know, he's got
that's true. You know what? If he's an enemy of Kiss, he might be a friend of mine.
He is an enemy of Kiss, so.
Yeah, so there's two positive things that I'll say about Kiss. They have really good movies. Oh, yeah. I'm a big fan of The Phantom of the Park, Detroit Rock City, and the Scooby-Doo movie. So there's that. And also, I do like the idea that Gene Simmons keeps touting publicly that there will be a touring incarnation of Kiss sooner rather than later that includes no original members. I think that that's an interesting concept. And if any band should do that, it's probably Kiss, because one, the musicianship will probably improve. And two, Kiss is definitely a brand more so than they are a band, in my opinion. And I don't even mean that as a slight. They were genius in the way that they built up their brand over the years. Gene Simmons is a marketing expert, as you said, and you know he built this brand into a powerhouse financial institution. So if any band should be the one sort of breaking out and doing this, it's Kiss. So those are two positive things I can say about them.
I think this would be good. So to me, like I said, there are a couple moments in their catalog that the first live album and Destroyer are, and actually Kiss Alive 2 is not too shabby either. So those are all pretty decent, good rock and roll stuff. But Ace, and I remember a review one point in time where they said, and this will mean nothing to you because it's a sports reference, but so just so you know, going into the quote, if you're a 300 hitter in baseball, you're very good.
Okay.
The Kiss album was typically the only 300 hitter on Kiss. Ace Frehley delivered the goods with, I think, Torpedo Girl was the song on that particular album.
So my number four, and this is where it starts to get a little weird and specific. Are you familiar at all with Aphex Twin? He is an electronic artist who has a substantial reputation from a series of albums and various remix projects that he's done. He took an extended break and then he came back a couple years ago with his comeback album. And the follow-up came out this year. It's called Cheetah. And to me, I really struggled with possibly placing this higher on the list because I personally loved it, but I loved it for a reason that isn't necessarily entirely based around the songs. While the songs are very good, what I loved about it, the title is derived from the Cheetah MS-800, which is an old school synthesizer that is famous for not really working that well. It's incredibly difficult to use. It is very poorly designed and didn't work. So as a personal challenge to himself, he created all of these songs using that synthesizer. I am a huge fan of analog synthesizers, as anyone who knows me in any way knows. So not only does this have that sort of vintage analog synthesizer sound throughout the entire album, the songs are built around it, and it's built around a synthesizer that is famously terrible. And he managed to make a set of really good, listenable songs using just that. And that, from a technical perspective, is incredibly impressive. I really like the songs, but the reason it didn't go higher on my list is I would just be putting it there for the technical achievement that the average listener would never realize was going on. So it's my number four pick. It is really good. Everybody should check it out. But before you do, to really have an appreciation for it, look up anything about the Cheetah synthesizer to get a genuine sense of what's happening in front of you. Watch any video of anyone playing that. And even if they're really good, it's going to sound terrible. So you'll understand what he accomplished with this record.
That, and the fact it was actually strapped on top of a live cheetah.
Yes, yeah. Just to add a little extra flair to it.
Many musicians were lost with the cheetahs. So my number three. So Brian Eno. Have you heard of Brian Eno, Mike?
It sounds vaguely familiar. Is that a band, like folky kind of thing?
Yeah. Used to be Simon, Garfunkel, and Eno, and then he kind of broke off and did his thing. But so Brian Eno.
I was confusing him with Eno, Lake, and Palmer.
Well, he was in that too. The Talking Eno Heads was another one. So he's been in a lot of groups. He was one of the Monkees, as a matter of fact. But here, what we're going to go through is listeners who either Nurture and Support or Squat Collar know that both Mike and I are fairly large Brian Eno fans, and he released some new material in 2016 called The Ship. 48 minutes worth of music, 4 songs. It's ambient, as Brian Eno is wont to do. This was fairly interesting that he still continues to evolve kind of the building blocks of what he needs to do. So to a degree, The Ship, some of the underpinnings of his thought process was like the Titanic in terms of the idea of hubris of man and things not working out and all of that. But rather than where he has used a lot of programmed music and electronic music to create these soundscapes and all of that for the ship, he still certainly introduces some of that, but he actually utilizes vocals much more in this album as the kind of primary instrument, if you will, to create the ambient involvement. But it's, if you like Brian Eno stuff, this is more that awesomeness there. It is kind of an interesting term because it becomes not lyrics, but just the voice. Becomes more of an instrument for the ambient sound. And anytime Brian Eno releases something, it's going to be one of my favorites for that year. The Ship was pretty clever there. It's actually interesting. The tracks are called, the first one's called The Ship. It was on vinyl, which I think you can get it. It's the whole first side. Side two's Fickle Son 1, 2, and 3. Fickle Son 3, I'm Set Free, is actually a remake or a cover of the Velvet Underground's I'm Set Free, which was on their third studio album. And so it's fairly interesting. And then if you happen to have access to the Japanese version of The Ship, you can get a bonus track called Away. The Brian Eno we know and love, but playing heavier into the vocal side of creating soundscapes and ambient music versus electronic.
Yeah, this is one that actually almost made my list, and it came down to this or Cheetah, because I didn't want to have Cheetah. Also is electronic based, obviously, and it has a very atmospheric, almost ambient quality to it. And the reason that I edged out Cheetah was just the technical side of it, because it's basically like, imagine an incredible guitar record played on a broken guitar that's on fire. Is the technical achievement of it. So that he's strapped to an actual Cheetah. So that's why it edged that out. Kelly and I are both huge Eno fans. So that was a tough decision to make, but I went just with the technical ridiculousness of the Aphex Twin record. My number three, which I'm guessing probably isn't on your list, and I am going to throw a little bit of a disclaimer in here. So one of my rules was nothing that I was involved in, which I was not involved in this record in any way, but some members who were involved in this band at different points do have ties to Pagan. However, that's not why I chose this. It is the new album from Dope. It is called Blood Money. This is just a great, great album. I've been a Dope fan since that band started. We have a lot of mutual friends with members of that band, and members of that band have done remixes and stuff of Pagan songs over the years. But they haven't put out a studio album in a while. And they have been touting this particular project for a couple years now, and fans have been really excited. And before I actually heard it, it was one of those things where I kind of started to feel like, because there was so much buildup, it wasn't going to live up to the expectations. And it really did. It's by far their best record. The songs are as heavy as anyone would expect for an industrial rock style band, but at the same time managed to be catchy and accessible in a way that they've never been before. And I just think it's a really great album. I think the best example is I played one of the songs for someone who I know doesn't like Dope as a band, and they were really impressed by it. And they started listening to it and ended up buying the album based on that. So that's my number three. But I do throw that disclaimer in there that there is some tangential links to that band. But I had nothing to do with this album. Nobody in Pagan had anything to do with this album. So
have you, so for my number two, Mike, have you heard of Iggy Pop?
Vaguely. Yeah. He was, I remember he did a tour with that incredible band that I love, Pearl Jam.
There you go. So you've been a Pearl Jam hanger on for a while.
That's real. That's not even a joke. I had to sit through Pearl Jam to see Iggy Pop.
To see Randy Newman, I had to sit through James. Well, I had Randy open for James Taylor. So rather than just walk out after Randy Newman got done playing, which is what I should have done.
Well, actually, yeah, you know what? I do have the order reversed. It was a co-headlining tour with Pearl Jam and Iggy Pop, and Mudhoney opened, and I like a couple Mudhoney songs. So Mudhoney was cool. It was nice to see them, and they played the three songs I actually knew from them, so that was cool. And Iggy Pop was incredible. I had always heard really good things about Pearl Jam, so I decided, you know what? Even though I don't like them, if there is an incredible live band, as everyone tells me, maybe it's worth sticking around for, and they were absolute garbage. They were just terrible. So, and, you know, I'm sure I caught them on an off night, but already not being a fan and then seeing a terrible show, I've completely washed my hands of Pearl Jam.
I can support that position.
But I am a big Iggy Pop fan. And if you're going to recommend what I think you're going to recommend, it's another one that almost made my list.
Post-pop depression is what I'm recommending.
Yes.
So interesting things there. So, from a stability standpoint, let's just say if there's the great normal curve or bell curve of stability, you know, Iggy's not pushing the envelope. he's always been a little unhinged and a little self-destructive, and so has always greatly benefited when somebody kind of connects in with him and helps just kind of steer him a little bit, his energies towards a direction. And so you saw Bowie do that early in Iggy's career. And then what happened here with post-pop depression is Josh Homme from the Queens of the Stone Age co-wrote a post-pop depression with Iggy. So I think he kind of helped channel a little bit of Iggy through there. So, but this, a lot of parallels there, because it just definitely is a very strong return to the edgier garage band, crazy hard Detroit-based magic that, you know, as we talked about Alice Cooper, was that became to, you know, Iggy and the Stooges, that kind of mojo introduced into the Alice Cooper group pulled them out of creating albums like Pretty for You and Easy Action into some masterpieces afterwards. So this is your classic Iggy. Has a song called American Valhalla, which is just about one of the best song titles I can think of. A great number of tracks. And this was where, from the explicit rating, I said Mike didn't need to do any of it because I did. The final track on the album is called Paraguay. And it includes the following. Iggy screams at the top of his lungs at the end of Paraguay, a sentence that probably Mike or I might have been screaming as we tried to get this show set up for today, which is, take your motherfucking laptop and just shove it into your goddamn foul mouth down your shit-heeled gizzard, you fucking phony, two-faced, three-timing piece of turd.
If ever a sentence was meant for a business card.
That could be our motto. Worth the price of admission alone. I've always liked Iggy. Loved Iggy in his role in the movie Suck that Alice was in as well. He was amazing. He's enjoyable. I'm glad he's still kicking, doing good stuff. This is a strong, strong outing. Iggy Pop's post-pop depression is my number two.
Excellent choice. It's another one that almost made my list. My number two, in fact, it was for my number two, I was thinking of... I had two sort of veteran artists, and I went a really different direction for it, though. And I almost didn't put this on my list simply because it's on so many people's lists for the wrong reason. I was looking at a lot of music sites, and this is like their number one, number two. It's up there on most of them, but for the wrong reason, because one of the members of the group died this year, and they're kind of putting it on there for that and not because it's a strong album in and of itself. I feel like this would have made my list either way. And it's the new album from A Tribe Called Quest. It is called We've Got It From Here, Thank You For Your Service. It is inexplicably a double album. I say inexplicably because it could have easily fit onto a single disc. It is split in half, which I can only assume was to sort of create the feel of, you know, flipping a record over kind of thing. And, you know, present it the way they wanted to present it. That's the only thing I can imagine, because the album, I believe, is about an hour long. Certainly could have fit onto a single disc. What is impressive about this album to me is that it really just sounds like the group's next record, which is kind of a big deal because they hadn't made an album in 18 years. And it really sounds like they haven't missed a beat. Like, this is just the next record in their catalog. And that's what's kind of cool about it to me. It sounds sort of retro in a sense because it doesn't match current production standards in a lot of ways, but in a good way. Because it seems like you're listening to one of their older classic albums, but it's all new songs you've never heard before. And that was kind of an interesting feel getting into this record. Again, one of the members did pass away this year. Not really a reason to listen to the album. You should listen to it for the material, not the same reason that everybody else is sort of plugging this as one of their top albums. My only sort of minor quibble with it is there's a fair number of guest artists on here. And are you familiar with the 90s rapper Busta Rhymes?
I certainly am.
He's on it a lot, like way too much. And he was on some previous Tribe Called Quest song, so it makes sense that he's on here. And obviously this is their final album at this point, because not only was there an enormous gap of time between albums, but now that one of the core members has passed away, this is going to be their final album. So it makes sense that he's on here, but he's on here a little bit too much. Off the top of my head, I want to say it's like four songs. Somebody should fact check me on that. But he's on like four songs on the album. It's a little too much Busta Rhymes for me. So minor quibble for an otherwise nearly perfect album that kind of creates, like I said, if you're familiar with their old albums, creates this weird thing where it sounds like you're listening to something from the early 90s from a production standpoint, but it's all songs you've never heard before. And it's, you know, not like leftover songs or anything. They're referencing current events in the lyrics. So it was an album I was really impressed with.
That sounds like one I need to pick up. Absolutely.
It's really good. And right, I mean, if you like Busta Rhymes, I'm not trying to put him down, but if you like Busta Rhymes, there's a lot of Busta Rhymes on this record, which is my only minor quibble.
There is an inordinately large number of Busta Rhymes posters throughout my household.
You know what? I would have suspected as much.
Yeah. A little Busta goes a long way. So it would be my recommendation in terms of how to utilize him. So interesting. So for my number one, there's some parallels here in that this album also, the artist died in 2016. And I'm not recommending it because they did. I'm recommending it because of the quality of the music in it. And that's Bowie's Black Star. Kind of reflecting when, you know, when all of a sudden David Bowie's not around to be putting albums out anymore, you start to realize that, man, this guy just consistently put out thoughtful, creative art in so many different ways, in so many different flavors, and I'll forgive him for Tin Machine, just really on that, but outside, and even that was survivable, but just a brilliant artist, many, many different things, and so yeah, Black Star is a fitting conclusion to his musical catalog. It's not a feel-good album. First song, Black Star, which is, title is not the word Black Star, but is actually a black star. So when you actually see it listed in track listings, it's not the word black star, it's a black star, which I thought was clever. It features an execution, and things just kind of go downhill from there through the album. So it's not a frolic through the park, but it's Bowie at his latest incarnation and best, always impressive in my opinion. Black Star follows up with "Tis a Pity She Was a Whore" as a second track, so he kind of comes out guns blazing in terms of that. No Iggy Pop esque lyrics, I can't match it up from there. But just, you know, the man was great. Music he put together, I've always been a huge fan of. This isn't something rushed out because he knew he was going. He said, "I'm going to have some work that goes out this." This is a complete work. This is a well thought out work. And he was obviously knew he was working under some constraints to get it done, but it bears no marks of, well, this is a slap job to get things out. It's really strong. Any album that features as part of the storyline, a cell phone falling from heaven and having consequence to there, that's the kind of thinking I can get behind. I'm going to have as my number one for 2016, David Bowie's Black Star.
That's an excellent choice. And that was one that I kind of had in my list, and it was popping around in different spots, and it was just something where, one, I kind of thought it might wind up on your list, so I felt like we were going to end up talking about it anyway. But for my number one, I ended up going with the album that I just listened to the most this year, because I had a bunch of different things that I was kind of popping in and out of number one when I was putting this list together in my head, and there's one album that I didn't even think of at first, but I must have listened to this album start to finish dozens of times this year.
And it's the remastered Raise Your Fist and Yell, isn't it?
It is Raise Your Fist and Yell, the 2-CD deluxe edition.
Extended cuts.
Extended live versions of every song.
Excellent.
with extensive audio commentary after each song. it's not Bowie, but I really did enjoy the Bowie album. I thought it was really cool. And it definitely, what I liked about it is they put a lot of thought into the vinyl release of it. And I don't want to give anything away for people, but if you bought especially the Barnes & Noble edition of the vinyl, there's a lot of cool stuff contained in that. It's definitely something that's worth mentioning for the package too, because you mentioned how, you know, this isn't something that was rushed out. It was a really well thought out, contained work, and the packaging and everything as well. If you purchased it, a physical vinyl copy of it had a lot of cool stuff. So it really was a really well thought out album. But for me, my number one just came down to an album that I've been listening to since it came out, just about every day, listening to something off of it. And I've listened to it back to front so many times. And that's the Uncanny Valley from, I'm going to say this wrong, I believe it's pronounced Perturbator. I'm probably saying this wrong. They are a synth pop act, or synth wave act, I should say. And if you're not familiar with what synth wave music is, it is modern music that has 80s kind of synth pop elements grafted into it, but with a much darker tone to it. And the album's called The Uncanny Valley, and it tells a story of sort of, you know, the dark side of technology through. And there's a mix of instrumental and vocal songs on there as well, with some guest artists providing vocals. But I really like 80s synth-based music a lot. As we discussed on the Apex Twin thing, I like old analog synthesizer-based stuff. And it's really cool to kind of hear modern production that incorporates elements of that sound. So synthwave music is something that I really enjoy, and especially when bands kind of push and do different things with it. And this album, more so than anything else that came out in that genre this year, really did that and really stands head and shoulders above the other things that came out in synthwave. Not to put any other group or artist down, but he just really pushed everything production wise as far as it can go up until this point. And it's an album that I listened to start to finish so many times that it was an obvious number one for me.
Any Raise Your Fist and Yell pulled into that?
No, I wouldn't say it's comparable to Raise Your Fist and Yell in any way. But we know when we get back to the Alice Cooper shows, everybody should know when that comes up. That might be the one to dethrone Billion Dollar Babies for you. Now, have you talked to Pat Boone? Have you guys discussed whether or not that can overthrow your choice for best album?
No, Mike, we have not had that conversation. So I don't know what we're going to do about that. No, we'll get to that. But let's dust off Pat Boo. Let's take excise, Raise Your Fist and Yell. And I think we've offered 10 pretty good choices out there for folks to listen to. We had, when this started off, I had told Mike, say, well, why don't you lead us off? Because this was Mike's idea to do it. That was a great idea. But, you know, on the off chance it didn't work out, I wanted to have deniability. Seems to have worked out quite nicely. I said, yeah, it's a good plan. Good plan. Glad we came up with it.
Well, you know what? I really enjoyed doing it, and it was cool to hear your picks. And I think there's a lot of stuff that would have been overlap had I not put really, you know, restraints on myself, because I probably could have done like a top 20. This could have been like a 4-hour show, and it's probably not the best idea.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess that's part of that's the good news is that there's still plenty of really good stuff. Don't have to look super hard to come across some great music. And these are 10 pretty good choices. If you haven't had a chance to intersect with some of these, you might want to take a look at a few of them. Well,
although I am a little bit disappointed the new Metallica album didn't make your list.
It didn't really make a cut, any cut whatsoever. So, well, we will. So if our math is correct, and we're not gifted at math, but our hunch is that this will be the last show of 2016 in the nurture and support squat cobbler conglomerate to finish off the year. Kind of suggesting some albums you might want to go take a look at. And as we'll roll into the next year, don't expect any more of us than you've already gotten, because I don't think we're going to get any better, but we're going to keep doing what we do.
And remember, kids, the fuckisode is coming.
Yeah, I guess 2017 will be the year of the fuckisode, so that we've got that to look forward to.
Oh, the year of the fuckisode. It just sounds good.
I was actually surprised. So when Mike advanced his concept for that show, I had my social media recommendation for that particular week was a lawyer. Much to my surprise, he expressed great interest and enthusiasm on the fuckisode. So he was looking forward to it, because when I put out the link for that, I did share that, you know, wanted to give folks the fact that in case your kids happen to be listening to you while you listen to podcasts, that particular episode where you made the pitch for the fuckisode, you made it early.
Yeah.
Wanted to kind of make sure the gang knew, said, hey, just happen to be listening to Squat Cobbler in the car. And frankly, what parent in their right mind would listen to Squat Cobbler?
Hey, kids, all gather around. Squat Cobbler's on.
Yeah, he's all in. So sounds like the people are demanding it.
The year of the fuckisode is upon us.
All right, gang. Well, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the list of albums, and you go check a few of them out. So I really appreciate everybody listening. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
You are the only censor. If you don't like what I say, you have a choice. You can turn me off.
I love the Monster Dog songs.